Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
Thanks for downloading this podcast from The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry, and if you're ready, we'll begin. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry. Thanks so much for listening on this Friday, where you will get at least five great things to find on the internet before your smart friends do. Such a deal, huh? You will take away at least two great suggestions for movies to see this weekend. But that's not all. We will also catch you up on the controversy surrounding Bill Cosby going from America's dad to America's biggest hypocrite in one fell swoop. But we begin with President Obama's decision for the federal government to stop deporting particular groups of undocumented immigrants and allow some of them to apply for work permits as well. We're going to get into the details of that this hour. The plan will apply to an estimated 3.7 million people, and the president insists he has the authority to proceed with this as a White House executive order.
And to those members of Congress who question my authority to make our immigration system work better, or question the wisdom of me acting where Congress has failed, I have one answer. Pass a bill. I want to work with both parties to pass a more permanent legislative solution. And the day I sign that bill into law, the actions I take will no longer be necessary.
But House Speaker John Boehner said today, now the president's actions have forced his hands. The White House must be stopped, he said.
We will not stand idle as the president undermines the rule of law in our country and places lives at risk.
Boehner's idleness came to an end on one issue today. His months-old threat to sue the president for overreaching on implementing Obamacare was finally filed in federal court today. The GOP apparently had some trouble getting a lawyer to take the case, but today they found one. Add to that this Caesar-like flourish from Texas Republican Senator Ted Cruz yesterday, doing an impression of the Roman master of rhetoric, Cicero.
When, President Obama, do you mean to cease abusing our patience? How long is that madness of yours still to mock us? When is there to be an end to that unbridled audacity of yours, swaggering about as it does now?
So much for a reasonable debate in pragmatic terms that Americans will be able to practically follow. Takeaway's Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick, along with Monica Campbell, join us. Monica Campbell is Global Nation Editor for PRI's The World. Todd and Monica, welcome.
Hi, John.
Hey, John.
The 3.7 million people who are going to be affected by this, they're not getting some get out of the immigration system free card, are they, Todd?
No, what they're really getting is a delay and sort of a reprieve. What this program really does, and it's important to drill down on this a little bit, and I'm glad we did off the top, because of the level of misinformation, not only in the rhetoric, but also in a lot of the reporting. What this program does, it does two main things. People have heard of Dreamers. They've heard of DACA, deferred action,
right,
where people who came here as young people were allowed relief from the threat of deportation and allowed to stay if they came at a certain young age and it had been here long enough. This program expands that program slightly. Increases the year, so adds about 275,000 people to that program. That's a relatively small slice of this. And then it takes the parents of those people and says, you can also apply for status under this executive order. If you get that status because your children qualify under DACA, that will mean that for 3 years, you can rely on the fact that you won't be deported, and you can also apply for a work permit for those 3 years. After those 3 years, if you don't reapply or if your status changes, you could still be deported.
So are the DACA parents eligible here or not eligible here? Monica, I don't quite get it.
I think that there's a lot of confusion. One family I talked to this week outside of San Francisco, where I'm based, they said, well, we might make it, but we might not because we might be off by 3 weeks from being eligible. So I think we're going to see the needles moved, but a lot of people still don't fit under this umbrella. I mean, you still have more than 11 million people estimated who are undocumented in the United States. The majority of the people are not, of that group, are not covered by what Obama talked about last night. So you've got a lot of people left out.
All right, we've got tons of responses from listeners on both sides of this, but some of what they're saying, I think, embodies some of the myths we want to puncture here. Before we go to them, let me just ask you one question, Todd. Is the key trigger here whether you have a child or not, or what time you decided to come to the United States based on this executive order?
It's both. It's both. The expansion here for parents of kids who qualify under DACA, it expands the number of kids to 2007, so it added about 275,000. And then the big expansion, which is probably something a little bit north of 4 million, is the parents of those people. Now, it's already the case under the law that parents of people who have green cards or who are normalized may apply. But a lot of people don't, because some of the requirements are stringent. They might be required to leave the country and come back. There's no guarantee that their application will be accepted. And if they leave, they're afraid they'll never come back. This takes away some of that uncertainty.
All right. So let's listen to what our listeners and people in the Takeaway community are saying about all of this. And there's a mix of forgiveness and a little bit of anger here. First, a little forgiveness.
Hi, this is Alexis from Hollywood, Florida. Even though the illegal immigrants are breaking some rules to get in this country, but believe it or not, they are, once they're here in this country, they are part of the economy. Some of them, they do jobs, odd jobs that a lot of Americans won't do.
All right, and here is a little more of the sentiments of Ted Cruz here.
Stewart in Louisville, Kentucky, as sad as it is, we cannot take in all of the immigrants that would like to come to the United States. It would bankrupt the country. There needs to be a more organized way to do this. Everybody that comes in needs to be paying their dues, and they need to have no criminal history.
Let's take the second one first, Monica. I mean, pay your dues and no criminal history, is that an ethos that's ever really been a part of the immigration system, that there's some sort of fee to get into the United States?
Yeah, I think what we're seeing is these lines being drawn about who's legitimate and who's not. And I think it's really complicated. And I'm sure that Todd knows this, that if you talk to people who've lived in the United States for a number of years without papers, it's really hard to have a very clean record. And I think you're in a city, New York, where you've got a lot of young men who are living and working in New York, sending money home every month, and they may be working under forged, you know, with forged papers. You get them when you can cross the border, you can pay more. And I think that we're going to see a lot of discussion about who's legitimate and who's not.
And if it's impractical to think of immigration papers and immigration normalization, Todd, as a, you know, good behavior medal for your time here in the United States, it's also the case that you can't simply assume that everyone who crosses the border, as Alexis said from Florida, is just a part of the economy. And poof, that makes them Americans somewhat like magic. That's not going to work either.
Well, this is part of the self-definition of a system where people live in the shadows. But it also works on the flip side, John. One of the difficulties of this program and doing it by executive order is you say, well, can't the next president who doesn't like it simply undo it? The answer is yes. Executive orders can get undone and are undone all the time, which right away makes this an election issue, as you can imagine. But it also complicates it for people who would apply. Why? Because they want to apply to not have the threat of deportation for the next 3 years. But they look at politics, they watch the news, and they say, gosh, if I go apply and my application isn't done, can't the next administration, if they want to undo all this, they're going to have my name and address. I might be applying for deportation.
So how does the GOP respond to this besides all the high-minded rhetoric?
Well, John, that's a big debate within the GOP right now, how to react. Nobody likes it. They are all reacting strongly, calling this an imperial presidency and Emperor Obama and everything else. But how can they react practically? It's a big question. I sat down for a little bit yesterday with Lamar Smith. He's a congressman, former chairman of the Judiciary Committee from Texas, conservative Republican, and he summed up part of it. Listen.
First of all, there's no reason in my view to pass legislation and send it to the president. One, he will veto what he doesn't like, and two, he won't enforce what he doesn't like either. We've seen right now he's not even enforcing current immigration laws. Why would we trust him to enforce new immigration laws? It's just not going to happen. What we're going to have to do and it probably will have to wait till the new year when Republicans control the Senate, is to try to defund his actions, not give him the money or deprive him of the money that he would use to implement his executive amnesty. We may file a lawsuit, try to see if we can overturn what he's done in court. And because it's so unprecedented, maybe the Supreme Court would be with us. That's a guess, and we don't know. But we will try everything every means we possibly have at our disposal.
So, John, a lawsuit, the Supreme Court, fairly self-explanatory. Defunding the effort's a little bit complicated. Here's why. Not as simple as it sounds. A lot of Republicans want to jump on a spending bill that's in front of Congress right now because government funding expires in the middle of December to defund this whole thing. The problem is that the Citizenship and Immigration Service, where all of this policy lives, it's funded on user fees, not by taxpayers. And that means that a spending bill legally can't just undo it. You think Congress can just wave a wand? They sort of can't. Also, if they do that, it sets up a potential shutdown scenario. Republican leaders like Mitch McConnell and John Boehner, they don't want that. They've said that already. Now, folks like Ted Cruz, we talked about him at the top. He says, McConnell, get tough. Block every single Obama nominee for the next 2 years until the president relents. Other voices within the Republican Party say we need to go directly at the president. Attach this to appropriations bills until the president bends. Force a government shutdown if we have to and blame the White House. We should censure. We should have resolutions of disapproval. And if those don't work, yes, John, from the fringes, maybe a couple of calls for sure for the president's impeachment. Speaker Boehner and future Majority Leader Mitch McConnell certainly don't want that talk. They're trying to tamp it down, but it is out there.
Here are a few more comments from our listeners. Marietta, Georgia says, yes, do what the president is doing. It will never pass with a totally Republican legislature. Do all you can while you can. Walnut Creek, California. I particularly liked his speech wherein he made reference to the 11 million undocumented workers that we can't pretend to ignore. And we can't ignore the fact that Republicans have acted on executive order on immigration as well. From San Antonio, Texas, no. He's too arrogant. The president is too arrogant about the things he wants. And Louisville, Kentucky, no, I think it should come from Congress. He had 2 years full Democratic control, 4 years GOP House and Democratic Senate, and now a GOP Congress. Give this new session a chance. Monica?
I think that last point was really key, that this does need to come from Congress ultimately. And a lot of immigrants themselves say that. They know this is a Band-Aid. It's a big Band-Aid, and it leaves a lot of people in limbo. And a real fix needs to be done, and that is part of a national conversation.
Monica Campbell is Global Nation Editor for PRI's The World. She's speaking with us from San Francisco. Todd Zwillick, of course, Takeaway Washington correspondent. Thanks to you both.
You bet, John.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
On the 104th anniversary of the Mexican Revolution, it is the sound of protesters being heard in the streets. That's in Mexico City. The disappearance and possible savage murders of 43 teachers in training hauled off by government officials in the city of Iguala, who turned them over to the brutal drug cartel assassins, has become a focus of national politics in Mexico. Fronteras reporter Lauren Madelon traveled to the city of Ojinaga in the state of Chihuahua, where violence from faraway Iguala is very familiar. Chihuahua's residents, who have long been used to living in a brutally violent state, are finally feeling bonded in what's beginning to look like a national movement. Lauren, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you, John. Good to be with you.
So what's it like in the places that you visited there in Chihuahua?
Well, there's a sense of hope and there's a sense of desperation at the same time. Hope that perhaps the revulsion that Mexican society is feeling right now will translate into hope for political reform, for political change, for a meaningful approach to the decoupling of organized crime and the political class.
Are the people of Ojinaga disillusioned with the government?
I think they are. You know, Ojinaga is a sepia-toned border town that at first glance doesn't look like very much. You peel back the layers, you realize that this was the seat of revolutionary fervor. 100 years ago, the famous Battle of Ojinaga took place, led by Pancho Villa. It was a critical turning point in the Mexican Revolution. And so there is a certain political awareness here that you don't find in other cities in Chihuahua. But I think what's happening right now is a realization that people can feel empowered to stand up and speak out. And surprisingly, it might seem to outsiders, that has not always been the case. But the revulsion over a case in Iguala in central Mexico, in the state of Guerrero, resonates here because there have been so many similar incidents, mass disappearances, mass killings, alleged ties to the government, that they understand what the people in central Mexico are going through. And clearly across the entire Mexican Republic, John, that feeling is also being felt. I spoke to many people who were celebrating Dia de la Revolución, the 104th anniversary of the Mexican Revolution. They are very much proud of their country, but they're also very disillusioned. I spoke to 35-year-old Jose Grijalda. He has two children. He's a hardworking guy. He's an example of the very middle class that the current Mexican president, Enrique Peña Nieto, likes to champion, who he says the focus should be on instead of being on bloodshed and the drug war. And he says, Jose Grijalda, that he's extremely disillusioned right now.
Before it was, oh, the narco's doing this. We have the government. You know, the government is going to do something about it. You know, we realize it's not. They're not. One side is the government. The other side is the narcos. And on the other side is our army. And we don't know where to go now.
So Jose Grijalda is, an insurance salesman, as you point out. He's a member of the middle class who might be quiet in certain circumstances like this, not necessarily political. So if he's speaking out, what's the word on the street?
The word on the street is that people are waiting. They're waiting for the other shoe to drop. And the reason I say that is because there has been revulsion earlier this summer. The army is accused in a massacre. About 4 years ago, a famous poet's son was murdered after being kidnapped in a very high-profile case. After each of these incidents, John, there have been people speaking out, but it's tended to fade away. It has faded away from certainly the headlines in Mexico and definitely in the rest of the world. This time it's different. People feel that protests are mounting. It's day after day after day, caravans descending on Mexico City. There was a seminal incident where the Mexican Attorney General, Jesus Murillo Caram, ended a news conference where he said, "Ya me cansé, I'm tired." And that triggered a viral response through social media where people said, "We are tired. We are tired of a government that will not protect us. We are tired of a government that took a month to arrest the alleged mastermind, the alleged intellectual author of this crime, that is the mayor of the city of Iguala, and his wife." Now, his wife is also a suspected cartel operative. She's had two brothers murdered in recent years, allegedly at the hands of cartel rivals. So the idea that this was a surprise that this mayor would be involved and his wife allegedly involved in these murders is met with disdain on the street because they're saying we could have predicted this. The other important note here, John, is that the mayor and his wife were representatives of the left, of the PRD. So this crime has sort of laid to waste any notion that the left might somehow rescue Mexico from its current crisis.
And people on the street are saying that, you know, this is a moment of truth and that from here on things change. I mean, that, many times people have said that, but there's a real sense of authority in some of the voices that you spoke with.
I would like to bring up and tell you about a gentleman that I met. He's a 23-year-old, educated, upwardly mobile Mexican. His name is Salvador Vasquez, and he addressed that point directly, John.
I think for the first time in some years, we all Mexicans are united, and this is not going to go away like other movements. That's a big thing because it's not very easy to get a Mexican angry, you know? And united, and now we are.
And that's a really important point. He says it's not easy to get a Mexican angry and united, and now we are. And you asked him at one point, and it was a very emotional response, what he thinks this crime is a symbol of. Let's listen to that.
Injustice, pain, fear.
And he's nearly crying there, right, Lorne?
He is. And you know what, John? He's crying for his country out of desperation, and he's crying for his country out of a sense of hope. I think that obviously there are many like-minded people across Mexico who are fellow travelers. They hope with everything in their heart that this movement will not dissipate as so many following other incidents of bloodshed in Mexico have.
Well, charting a difficult and challenging and possibly politically violent future for the state of Mexico, Lorne Madelon is reporting from the city of Ojinaga in the state of Chihuahua, where Iguala's crimes are very familiar, and this national movement to figure out how the government can get its credibility back is very much on the street. Lauren Madelon, thanks so much.
You're welcome, John.
Lauren Madelon is a reporter for Fronteras, a collaboration of public radio stations along the Southwest focused on the U.S.-Mexico border. Your conversation is about the president's immigration decision. How do you feel about him going it alone? From Charlotte, North Carolina, as I help my kindergartner prepare for his Thanksgiving play, I'm reminded we really are a nation of many immigrants. I do support action on immigration, and I think it's unlikely without executive action, so I support the president's decision. You can give us a call. Our number is 877-8-MY-TAKE.
I'm going to give Sonny Liston talking lessons, boxing lessons, and falling down lessons.
Leave my sister and my daughter.
Because I bloody well stammer.
None of you entered my kingdom. I leave you nothing that I wish you plague.
I don't know what we're yelling about.
My sister and my daughter. We haven't heard that clip in a while. It's Friday. Movie suggestions from our good team, Kristen Meinzer and Rafer Guzman, co-hosts of the Movie Date podcast, the wildly popular Movie Date podcast. Rafer and Kristen, welcome.
Hi, John.
So the two movies that are big this week, I mean, the one really huge monster movie, it's Mockingjay. Jennifer Lawrence is back. Director Francis Lawrence is back. The Hunger Games Mockingjay Part 1.
You're all from the Capitol? Plutarch got you out?
Don't expect much chit-chat from him. Capitol cut his tongue out years ago. And no, it wasn't any sort of rescue, if that's what you mean. We all fled on our own. For this. For you.
And you can't possibly understand what's going on there, but it's all very dramatic and intense and the end of the world. Kristen, what did you think?
Well, you know I love The Hunger Games.
I know.
And I devoured those
kids.
Books in
my
1 week.
Love.
And yep. I actually liked the second one better than the first. The second one, same director, Francis Lawrence. However, this one, much like that clip we just heard, is a lot of people talking, a lot of people explaining. There's a lot of bureaucracy. There's a lot of meetings. It's not all the excitement that you want from The Hunger Games. And frankly, I don't think they needed to break Mockingjay into Part 1 and Part 2. I think they should have just kept it one, kept the drama high, kept the action high. This is a lot of slow talking about how government works.
So it's a little bit of the Star Wars Clone Wars.
I'm not sure I would go that far,
yeah,
but
yeah.
I have to agree with Kristen. That clip that you're hearing is Jennifer Lawrence being followed around by a reality TV crew, essentially, and the whole movie is her making warring propaganda videos and the Capitol making their own propaganda videos, and I found that it all got pretty boring, and I felt like, where's the social insight? Where's the commentary that I was expecting from this movie? And where are the feminist bona fides that people kept trumping up about this film? And I feel like this whole franchise is starting to let me down on those fronts.
How about Stanley Tucci's hair? Is he in this?
He's barely in this.
He's very, very briefly. He's great as always.
He's great as always, and has a good costume.
Yeah, everyone's got pretty good costumes. And of course, this is one of Philip Seymour Hoffman's last roles.
Oh, that's right.
He's in it. So is Julianne Moore. When they're on screen, even though they're not doing much, they're a pleasure to watch. The rest of it, I think, is pretty dull.
Film number two, Pulp, a film about life, death, and supermarkets. Here's a clip.
When did you first realize it's time you took an older
I guess this is a music picture, Rafer?
It's a documentary on the band Pulp from Sheffield, one of the great leading lights of the Britpop scene in the 1990s. This is really them giving their final farewell hometown concert. I think if you're a diehard Pulp fan, you might enjoy this. Other people, I think, are going to get a little less out of it.
It's not as it doesn't have as much impact as Stop Making Sense.
I don't think so. I also think that this is really a movie for Sheffield. It's a Valentine to Sheffield, the town where Pulp comes from. And, you know, frankly, I'm a huge Pulp fan, and even I wasn't totally excited about this because I needed more information about what Sheffield is, the history. And it doesn't dive in deep. It stays on the surface. you know, you get to hear some of your favorite Pulp songs, and that's great, but I would have loved a little bit more from this.
Good concert footage, but doesn't hang together as a doc.
I would say that, yes.
And on the podcast?
We're going to talk about what you can watch on Thanksgiving, all the TV specials, all the movie specials, all the crazy shows, including When Turkeys Attack.
How many references to It's a Wonderful Life?
I don't know. Ooh. Maybe some Charlie Brown in there.
Kristen Meinzer and Rafer Guzman, co-hosts of the Movie Date podcast. Thanks so much.
Thanks,
John.
Bill Cosby's days of chuckles and asking big questions like why is there air to outrageous laughter, of being white America's favorite kindly black entertainer, those days may be over. The rape allegations against him, which have been around since 2005, stories of strong drinks, passed out women, and forced sex are overwhelming Cosby's long career as a performer and his role as some kind of conscience figure in race-challenged America. Cosby's denials and determination to continue performing, even as his reputation sinks, has raised a new question, and it's not funny. Forget why is there air. How about why is there tolerance of rape and sexual abuse by celebrities, and we might include athletes in that category, given the discussions of the past few months. Here to talk about that is Jill Filipovich, attorney and political writer for Cosmopolitan.com. What are your thoughts on all of this? I mean, you were a fan of The Cosby Show growing up, right?
I was a fan of The Cosby Show, but I think that your intro was right, that we do tend to look the other way, especially when it's male celebrities, male athletes, you know, or men who, you know, whose work, whose art we admire.
And, you know, he took on this role as conscience of the black community when he, you know, went out against misogynist lyrics in hip hop music and, you know, that African-Americans have to be more educated and be better to succeed, and really railing against some of the more strident comments in the black community, and took a lot of criticism for that. You kind of have to wonder, how did he think of himself as a conscience when he knew all of this was going on, if the allegations are true?
Right. I mean, at the very least, he's an enormous hypocrite. Even if none of the allegations are true that he sexually assaulted these women, you know, which seems sort of unlikely given the volume of the accusations and the consistency of them, you know, but even if all he did was have consensual sex with these women, he's still an enormous hypocrite. I mean, he's married. He has been putting himself out there as this moral center and moral voice. He has very specifically criticized African-American women for having multiple sexual partners, children with many men, you know, and then he's out there, right, at the very, very least, cheating on his wife.
And, you know, Ta-Nehisi Coates, who's a great African-American young writer who wrote a celebrated piece about Cosby back during this period when he was trying to be this sort of conscience of the black community, has now written a new piece all about these allegations. And it's so emotional here. Let me quote it a little bit. I've often thought about how those women, people in the allegations, and he knew about the allegations when he was reporting this piece, those women would have felt had they read my piece back in 2007 or 2008. The subject was morality, and yet one of the biggest accusations of immorality was left for a few sentences, was rendered invisible. I don't have many writing regrets, Ta-Nehisi Coates says, but this is one of them. I regret not saying what I thought of the accusations and then pursuing those thoughts. I regret it because the lack of pursuit puts me in league with people who either looked away or did not look hard enough. I take it as a personal admonition to always go there, to never flinch, and to never look away. What do you make of those powerful statements from a very trusted African-American writer?
I love that piece by Ta-Nehisi. I'm a fan of his generally, and I think he's on point that he and many other writers really didn't want to dig into this ugliest set of accusations. It feels very fraught. It feels like there's a lot of potential liability to be accusing a powerful man of assault.
He also spoke very candidly about, I was a young writer. I was living off of a freelance salary. I had a kid. I was writing about this big guy. It was my first big break. Boy, if I had taken this the wrong way and gotten him mad at me, it could have wrecked my whole career. He really cops to that, which shows you how much power someone like Cosby has, even among the journalists who might be willing to try to take him down.
Exactly. And, you know, Ta-Nehisi was a journalist and, you know, freelance, but one would assume had at least some backing from a large journalistic institution. You know, and you compare that to a lot of the women that were accusing Cosby of sexually assaulting or raping them. You know, these were women that were often very young, that were often very new in their industry, and that were often brought to Cosby by their own agents or people who they trusted. You know, so who were they supposed to go to, and who would have believed them? What were these women supposed to do?
Is there something about men who get this kind of power who feel a certain entitlement? Is it something on the male side that's also driving this as well?
I think that might be part of it. You know, I do think it's important to emphasize that most men, no matter how powerful they are not rapists or
exactly.
sexual predators.
Yeah.
What we do know, you know, from people that have studied these things is that men who are sexually predatory tend to have many, many victims. And they tend to be enabled by communities that either look the other way or that prop up the kind of sexist myths that allow them to feel like they can continue acting the way they do. So, you know, I think we really need to change the culture around this stuff and then target, you know, the handful of very sadistic men who commit these acts.
Well, like athletes who lose their endorsements, Cosby is losing projects, losing investments on the part of media operations. He's still performing. He'll be performing this weekend, if I'm not mistaken. Has your view of Bill Cosby changed as a result of all this?
It has. I mean, I wouldn't imagine that there's anyone in America who hasn't at least, you know, thought twice about Bill Cosby. However, they, you know, however people come down on how they feel about him, I think that this story is important because it does sort of push us to examine whether there are heroes or people that we like, you know, and realize that no matter how much we like someone's TV show or their music or how well they play on the field, we have to make an assessment of how much does their actual life and their choices as human beings and the way that they treat other human beings, how much should that impact our consumption of the things that they make or, you know, the sport that they play? How much should we be giving our resources and our money to people, you know, who behave very, very badly when they're off camera or off the field?
You know, by that argument, did Bill Clinton get away with it?
I think if the Clinton Lewinsky situation were happening today, we would have a very different conversation about it. You know, I think especially with kind of the rise of the feminist internet and a much more sophisticated understanding of power differentials, you know, in things like sexual harassment, you know, I don't think that we'd be turning, well, I would hope that we wouldn't be turning Monica Lewinsky into a national joke, that, you know, we would take seriously the fact that she was, what, 20 years old? I mean, she was a kid, you know, and here was one of the most powerful men, arguably the most powerful man in the world, you know, and that it wouldn't have sort of been brushed off as a series of jokes about, you know, a cigar and a blue dress.
Jill Filipovich is an attorney and political writer for Cosmopolitan.com. Thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
The president on his own offered a helping hand to 3.7 million unauthorized immigrants. Good idea or overreach?
Hi, my name is Rich from Pacifica, California. I believe that every illegal immigrant should be given a correct path to citizenship by a certain date. If they fail, they need to be deported.
Love to hear your thoughts at 877-8-MY-TAKE. If you want to catch up on that conversation or listen back to anything on the program, check us out at thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. Have a great weekend. This is The Takeaway.